Ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by Hagen Oaks, America's most awarded golf facility, and Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
Hello and welcome to the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports, 1140. Hi, I'm Frank LaRosa. There's Scott Marsh sitting next to me. We're in studio tonight, Scott.
It is fantastic to see you, Frank.
It's nice to be back. And another great show tonight. Mike Woods is going to kick things off, PGA Director of Golf at Hagen Oaks. We're going to talk about pace of play. How about that?
Good, because that's always a big one on my mind when I golf.
Yep. Donna Archer is the president of the George Archer Memorial Foundation for Literacy, and she's going to explain what all of that means. George Archer had a secret that he kept while he was winning 14 PGA tournaments, a Masters, 20 on the Champions Tour, and five around the world, I think. But he was carrying a secret that probably made it tough to do that, and we'll learn more about that. And then we will finish up tonight with Lane Lewis. Lane is the owner of Old Brockway Golf Course. That's on your list now, I think.
It's definitely on my bucket list, and I can't wait to talk to Lane. This is a course, if you haven't heard about it, in North Lake, Tahoe, that you're going to want to play. You're going to want to hear the story about this course. It is historical for sure.
You know, I think the great part about having guests that have a lot to say is people don't have to listen to us talk about where we played golf this week. So
nobody wants to hear about that.
Exactly. So we'll pause for a couple of messages. We'll be right back with Mike Woods right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
You are listening to Sactown Sports 1140. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. I'm Frank LaRosa, and Mike Woods is with me. Mike is the PGA Director of Golf at the Hagen Oaks Golf Complex, and Mike has been there a number of years. He's certainly past his probation at this point. Mike, how many years you've been at Hagen Oaks?
Oh, man, you're aging me, Frank. This is year 33.
Gosh. Good for you. Of course, you started, you know, as a baby in someone's arms, right?
Of course. Yes. I think I was eight. Yes.
You know, I know a little bit about your story, but when you were at Sac State, you were a soccer player.
I was. I grew up playing a lot of soccer, a lot more than golf, and a lot of competitive soccer around the West, and played at Sac State and really enjoyed that. And eventually, that game just was wearing out my body, and my love of golf at the same time really was growing. And so it ended up being a pretty easy decision for me.
Well, you talk about, being in the right place at the right time. What an incredible run you've had at Hagen Oaks, and it continues. And your game has certainly improved over the years. You're playing at a top level right now. I hear from other pros, you know, that you show up at a tournament and they go, oh, here comes Woods. We better get on our A game today.
Well, it's funny how that works. You know, I've played pretty good my whole life, but when you have kids and you're coaching and you're doing all the kids stuff with music and everything, you know, you're just not putting the time in your game. It just goes in the toilet. And so I've got two kids that are one that's out of college and one that's a junior in college. And I'm making this big commitment to my golf game over the last couple of years. Probably has something to do with being over 50 and being a senior, playing in the senior events too. But I'm finding I can perform. Imagine that.
I played with you, and I know you get it around the course pretty well. So it's always a pleasure to play with you. And when I think about you, I always think about the tournament we played with the NCGA and the California Golf Writers so many years ago. So it's been a great run.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it's so fun to get out there and compete. I just get reminded of that all the time.
You know, I want to talk today a little bit about pace of play. And, you know, and when you mention pace of play, you know, the hairs on the back of people's necks start to stand up, because everybody, I think, when the term comes up, it's like, well, it's not me. You know, and there's a little bit of guilt from some people, and others, it's like, well, it's not me, it's the group in front of me. And I don't think that even, you know, what we refer to as marshals, and you refer to them with a different term at Hagen Oaks, but, you know, they don't even want to come up and bother somebody's game. But it's just a matter of just trying to keep a pace of play throughout all of the people on the golf course so that everybody's having a good time.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, Frank, in the different survey work I've done with golfers, thousands and thousands of golfers over the years, what we've just consistently learned is that proper speed of play is super important to golfers. It is really important to everyone. It usually shows up number three on the list of what's most important to me when I play golf is pace of play. Nobody wants to be out there for 5 or 6 hours, and especially in a warm Sacramento day. So yeah, you're right on with that. And then the question is, how do you get it done? Right. Because knowing that people want to play golf in 4 to 4.5 hours and then actually getting it done is a challenge. And that interpersonal communication between somebody at the golf course and a golf group or a golf player who's struggling with their speed of play is vital, that it's friendly and that it's done in the right, with the right tone. And not all courses get that right.
You know, I think we have an expectation that all golfers know everything. You know, they know all the rules, they know all the etiquette, and we don't. You know, I don't know certainly all the golf rules, and you know, I will fake it here and there where need be, and if I have to look at a rule book, I will. But with etiquette as well, and it's not even a matter of etiquette; it's a matter of not knowing that, you know, if I did this over on the tee as opposed to here at the green, I'm just going to move things along. And you move things along, you know, 20, 30, 40 seconds a hole, you know, you've cut a huge piece of time off your round.
Yeah, that's so true. You've nailed it. It's just a little pattern here and there. And it's 10, 20 seconds a hole. And next thing you know, you're right up with that group in front of you, and you're relaxing and having a great time with your friends. Speeding up is not some big major anything. It's just a couple little patterns here and there. And, you know, we believe in it so much that in our golf carts on the cart placard, we have 6 things we want you to do when you play golf to keep up the pace of play and keep up with that group in front of you. And some of them are so, you know, normal and natural, it almost is silly to put them on paper. But to your point, we find when we approach a group maybe that's struggling with their pace of play, and our goal is to make friends with them and then to educate them a little bit about maybe a pattern they can do a little differently that will help them fit in. When you take that approach of educating, we find golfers are really receptive, and they, you know, everybody wants to fit in. Nobody wants to be a problem. And when we go through a couple of these things with them, they go, huh, I didn't know that, or I've never considered doing that before. And it really makes a difference.
It sure does. And you mentioned keeping up with the group in front. And sometimes there's this notion that, well, you know, I'm a half a hole ahead of the group behind me, so I'm doing fine. But, you know, if you're a hole and a half behind the group in front of you, well, people 4 holes back are having a tough time.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth? Yeah. And, you know, most of the courses in town, the standard is 4.5 hours. And some of the country clubs have it at 4 hours or 4 hours and 15 minutes. But if you're a public golfer, 4.5 is really the model around town here. And if you just do the math on that, that's 15 minutes a hole. And you can easily self-assess. And in our case here, like on our McKenzie course, we know it's 1 hour to play 4 holes and 2 hours to play 8 holes and 3 hours to play 12 holes. And it's pretty simple. That's true at all the courses in town. If you stay near or ahead of that standard, you got nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
And a lot of golfers don't realize that. I mean, you could be 5 minutes ahead of that speed of play, and the group in front of you is 2 holes ahead of you. That's okay, because you're ahead of the 4.5 hour pace. We have early morning groups out here at Hagen that play golf in 2.5 hours.
Wow.
If you were 2 holes behind them, guess what? You're not slow.
Yeah.
They're just really fast.
Let's kind of go through some of those things, you know, those aha things that, you know, people may just have never considered. So let's say we've got a group going out in a cart, and you know, I hit my ball left and my partner hits the ball right. So, you know, you're going to drive to the ball that's next to hit. What does the guy in the cart do at that point? Does he sit there and watch me hit, or does he move to his ball and I walk? Take me through that.
Yeah, that's one of our six, because that's a big one. And so, you know, that's one of the beautiful things of golf is we ride together, have great conversations, enjoy time together. But when we're playing golf and, you know, I rip my drive down there and then Frank hits it 80 yards by me like he normally does with his driver. The goal is that we go to my ball and I get dropped off. I take my laser, shoot my yardage, grab my club and get dropped off so that Frank can start moving to his ball. And then I go through my routine and I hit my shot and then I start walking to the cart. And that really speeds things up. And at times Frank might even swing back and pick me up as I'm walking. But by one golfer getting dropped off and the other starting to move to their ball and hitting their shot, that's that 10, 20 seconds on a hole that makes all the difference in the world. Now, what we see a lot at the golf course is we see the driver of the cart just sitting in the cart while the other player is hitting and then just waiting for that individual, and they play and then they get in the cart and then the cart goes, you know, to the other side of the fairway and one golfer sits in the cart and the other is hitting. And that's a much slower way of playing golf. And so we really like the drop off. It really gives you a little more exercise too, which is nice. And it just keeps things really flowing.
And one of the other things that I've noticed that will happen is, you know, if the driver is waiting, I've hit my shot. So now I'm going to clean my club. I'm going to put my head cover back on, and then I'm going to take the time to put it in the bag and then go back in the cart, as opposed to get in the cart with your club, drive to the other guy's ball, then you clean your club while he's doing that. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you got to be efficient out there. You got to recognize that part of golf is keeping up in this normal, proper pace of play. And choosing when you do certain things is really important. We're big proponents of when a group is struggling a little bit of pace of play, that first player in the group to hole out, let's say you're on the fourth hole and you go ahead and roll in your putt. Well, what do? You walk to your cart and go to the next tee and hit it. And then you write your scores. And what we see all too often is all four players standing on the green, everybody just standing there while the last putt or two is being hit. And then we put the pin in, then we start writing scores while we're standing on the green, or maybe we get in the cart and start writing scores. And that's that 20, 30 seconds again, where if you hole out and head to the next tee and hit it, then you have all kinds of time to clean your clubs, to write scores, to have a conversation, because you've already hit the next tee shot and you're just waiting for your rest of your group to come. And in fact, in many of the junior tours now, that holing out and going to the next tee and hit it is mandatory.
Oh, wow.
Tours. It's part of the program. You have to do that. Otherwise you get penalized. That's how important it is.
Let's talk about what ready golf really means, because, you know, I think for some people, having the longest drive is really important to them. So they're not going to hit their shot until everybody else has hit their shot because I've got the longest drive. But, you know, if you've got the longest drive and you're at your ball first, go ahead and hit it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating. So I think it's about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, the United States Golf Association put in the USGA rules of golf, ready golf. And so up until that point, you know, you watch on TV, you really needed to have that player that hits, that's farthest away, hit first. But the USGA recognizes that that's a killer for pace of play. It just really makes the game less fun when you're just standing there waiting for somebody because they happen to be 10 feet farther away from you. And so ready golf is just play when you're ready. It doesn't matter who's far enough away. You just want to play when you're ready and when it's safe to do so. You never want to be hitting over somebody or have somebody in a dangerous situation. But that's not only just like a rule at a golf course. That's actually in the USGA rules of golf, that you play ready golf every time you play golf in a tournament, with your friends, in a league. It doesn't matter. Ready golf is now the new norm.
And again, I want to emphasize the fact that I don't think anything that we're talking about is designed to take the fun out of the game. I mean, it's just designed to kind of improve, how we get from the first tee to the 18th green. And, and as you say, everybody wants to play, in a reasonable manner and not be out on the golf course for 5.5 hours. So these are just things that you can think about as you're playing. And, still trash talk and still do all the things that you want to do and brag about your tee shots and all those things. You just do it at the right time so that, you're just kind of keeping things moving and you're not frustrating the group behind. And we have all been in that, quote, group behind where we're frustrated by the group in front of us. That's the, that's not moving along or whatever. But the game is supposed to be fun. Let's help it be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And, one of the things we remind golfers of a lot as well is that this is a sport. You're an athlete. And so we want you to walk like an athlete, play like an athlete. And we have this conversation a lot with competitive golfers. If your chin is up high, you're walking with a good pace. You're moving like an athlete. It does a wonderful thing for how your body feels and for your outlook on your next shot. If you kind of have your head down and you're sagging and you're walking really slow and you're not walking like an athlete, you're setting yourself up for a poor next shot. And so remember, golf is an athletic sport, and the way you carry yourself and the walking with purpose really helps to lower your scores and to have a better mental attitude. And it also helps with pace of play. So we really encourage people to do that. Have your chest up, your chin up, walk with a purpose. You'll find that you'll not only play faster, but you probably shoot a lower score as well.
That may be the best piece of advice I've ever heard. I like that. I'm going to walk like an athlete from now on. It may be a sumo wrestler, but it's going to be an athlete.
Absolutely. I mean, did you ever watch in the day Michael Jordan walked back to his basket with his head down? I mean, that would be silly, right?
Yep.
And we see that in all athletic sports, and golf is no different. And we watch golf on TV. We see that player who's playing so well. Boy, they look like an athlete. They walk like an athlete. They walk with purpose. We saw that in the British Open, all those players walking down the fairway. Hey, if you want to play well, that's where it starts.
Let's all be athletes, and in the process, we will make our game of golf a little bit quicker than it was maybe the last time we played.
Yeah, you bet.
Mike Woods, the PGA Director of Golf at Hagen Oaks. Mike, it's always a pleasure. You always have something new to tell us, and appreciate your time here on the Golf to Go Radio Hour.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
Sacktown Sports 1140 continues here with the Golf to Go Radio Hour. I'm Frank LaRosa. Scott Marsh is here beside. And I am so excited to welcome a wonderful friend of mine that I've known for years. And her name is Donna Archer. And Donna is the wife of the late George Archer, who is especially well known here in Sacramento for all of his visits to the Gold Rush tournament. But George was a tour player that won, if I'm not mistaken, 14 times on tour, and was the winner of the Masters as well. Hello, Donna. How are you today?
Hi, Frank. Good to talk to you. I'm doing good now that I'm on the radio with you or wherever we are.
That's the question. Where are we? The where are we question, prompts me. I'm going to go way back here to get the start. Where you and George met, and I'm not sure that I ever knew the complete truth to the story. I don't know whether you were up here chasing him because you wanted to meet him, or you just happened by chance. But but I know you met George at the State Fair tournament here at Hagen Oaks.
I did, yes. And back in the day, they didn't call them groupies. I'm not sure what they called them, but my father was actually playing in the tournament, the State Fair tournament. And our family had been in San Francisco the week before watching the Northern California medal play at Cal Club. And we happened to see George win one of his first important tournaments. tournaments, we were just in the gallery. So the following week, when we went up to play in the state fair, my father went up to play, I saw George was in the field. And because I had seen him win the week before, I actually wanted to watch him play golf. I wasn't really looking to meet him. I was only like 10 years old. So, I mean, I was a little bit older. But anyway, he happened to see me on the 13th hole, and he had really hadn't been dating anybody. He didn't have a girl. He didn't even know what a girlfriend was. And so he actually didn't come over, but his playing partner was Vern Callison, well known in your area.
Sure, yeah.
And he sort of gave George the elbow in the rib and pointed. And so George came over and stood beside me. And my first words to him were, "Congratulations, George, on winning the Northern California Medal Play." And I think he was so surprised anybody knew he had won that tournament. So it was pretty funny. He was very cute. Well, thank you very much.
And a storybook romance began right there.
Exactly. Well, it was my little white dress, I think.
You know, you were out on tour with George. In those days, you all kind of traveled by automobile from tournament to tournament. But tell us what that was like in those days. And I know you were friends with the Stocktons, Dave Stockton, and you all kind of certainly didn't live together, but you all supported each other on the road.
We did, yes. And if we were going to go, in those days, the tour went from Tucson to Miami. So several of us, we didn't really follow each other in cars, but we were on the road at the same time. And in my opinion, it was really, really fun. It's way different nowadays, and not everybody thought it was fun. But if you wanted to be on the tour, you were happy to do whatever it took to be on the tour. And that included driving all over the country. And in those days, we hardly knew where the golf course was. And I think it's kind of funny, but I'm kind of embarrassed to say they didn't really even have many hotels in those days. So none of us knew where we were going to stay. We didn't know how far from the golf course the hotel was, blah, blah, blah. But it was all a great, great adventure. Many of us had young children at the time as well.
And your oldest daughter actually caddied for George when she grew up. That had to be a real family affair at that point. That had to be fun as well.
Well, it was very fun. And the reason that she caddied for him is when she got to be around 16 years old, she didn't want to go on the tour anymore. And of course, when your kids are in school, the only time that the whole family is together is in the summer. So I said to her, "You have to go on a tour. You don't have a choice. Why don't you caddy for your dad and can see what it's like to be a professional athlete?" She was an athlete herself, and you can earn some money, etc. And I kind of had a hard time talking George into it, but it turned out to be just a wonderful experience for both of them. I felt that a daughter should kind of know what her father's job was like. And George eventually said that she was the best caddy he ever had. So it was quite a wonderful thing to have had happen.
It was all meant to be from the beginning at Hagen Oaks.
Apparently.
You know, Donna, when you think about George's career, and as you mentioned, you know, the life on the tour was hard then. It was hard to win. And when you win, you didn't win all that much money. But for George to win as many tournaments as he did and then take home a Masters trophy as well, was he satisfied with his career, or was it, you know, there was always more out there?
Well, I think George was a bit of an exception as a professional because he never looked back on what he had accomplished. He was always looking presently. He was hardly looking ahead either. He was just focused in the minute, which is a lot of conversation you hear nowadays. You did not hear in those days, but it certainly was what George's professional characteristic was. So was he satisfied with his career? I think that both of us had kind of jaw-dropping moments where, like, really? You won all these tournaments? You won the Masters? How the heck did that all happen? So I don't think it was ever a matter of being satisfied or not. It was more being thrilled. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And one of the things that you had said to me many years ago, and I always found really, really incredible, was that George always wanted, he never rooted or wanted anybody to root against the people he was playing. He always wanted them to play their very best so that if he won, he knew he beat them at their best.
Exactly. In fact, he taught me, that was one of the first lessons he taught me, if you want to follow me around, you can never root against my opponent. And he had great respect for his fellow professionals. And he behaved that way his entire 40-year career. It was 25 years on the regular tour and 15 years on the Champions Tour, where he ended up winning 20 tournaments on that. And then he won 5 international tournaments as well. But he always had great respect. He understood what was required in the game. And he knew and loved golf. He knew golf. And he also knew that you never root against the referee. If there is one, if you get a bad call, fine. You're going to get a good call sometime. So he never whined or moaned about, well, he called that out of bounds or whatever the call might have been. So those things, I think, made him stand out as a professional. Never root against your opponent and never moan or whine about a bad break. And he never bragged about his wins either. If you sat around with him at the dining table, he was never going to talk to you about the wins that he had, which maybe was the third quality that I think made him unusual as a professional.
We're talking to Donna Archer, wife of the late George Archer. George was an incredible professional throughout his career, but he had a secret that he was carrying, a deep and troubling secret that that he gave you permission to tell people about after he passed away a number of years ago. What was George hiding from the rest of the world?
Well, George was unable to read and write beyond the third grade level. He had a little bit of skill, but not beyond the third grade. And he went to great lengths to keep that a secret throughout his life, which was a very painful thing for him. But, you know, in reflecting on it, it wasn't the major event of his life, I guess I would say, because if you can't hear or you can't see or you don't have a finger or you don't have something that other people have, you learn to deal with it, don't you? You perform or go on with your life without it. And so that's what he did. But it was never anything that he didn't try to overcome, even toward the end, and just never had the ability to learn how to read beyond that or write.
And George's admission through you resulted in an incredible program that you are now president of the George Archer Memorial Foundation for Literacy, and you and your committee members are doing all that you can in Northern California to help promote literacy, especially in children that that have learning difficulties. So congratulations there. Tell me a little bit about the foundation.
Well, the foundation, and there are wonderful people that are part of our board, and started 15 years ago. We've had great support from Stockton, and so we have a band in October at the Peninsula Club where George really learned how to play golf because he started there as a caddy. And so the club has been wonderful in supporting us, and we have an event where we raise money, and that money is distributed throughout the Bay Area and hopefully beyond for programs and children who struggle with reading. Unfortunately, literacy is not an issue that's well or widely understood. And part of that is because so many of us can read and write. So it's difficult to imagine what it's like for a child who struggles. And part of the struggle that the foundation has, I think, is getting that message across that it is urgent that people know how to read and write, and that many children don't learn very easily. So hopefully we're going to improve. And I want to thank you, Frank, for everything you've done for the foundation, because you have been a warrior, just wonderful, particularly just supporting me and keeping me stable.
You're pretty stable on your own, Donna, but I appreciate that. Scott, can you imagine being a professional athlete and you know, reading at a third grade level? I mean, the inability sometimes to do autographs or you know, read a card somebody handed to you.
You know, Donna, I appreciate you sharing that so much, and I admire George and his courage that he gave you to share that story too. I can only say, over the years, Frank, I've worked with many athletes, and one of my toughest, you know, situations, I was working with a basketball player, and I was asking him to do some station reads and what I thought was pretty standard stuff, right? And he got pretty upset with me about it, you know, and I wasn't asking anything out of the ordinary, and I walked away and I was thinking, what did I do wrong, or what's the situation here? Well, it turns to find out, I found out that that individual athlete couldn't read. Mm. And I'd put him in such an awkward situation, Donna, and I had no idea. And I still feel bad to this day about that, because, of course, that was not what I was trying to do. But I have great sympathy for those who have a struggle like that. And I can only imagine what it was like for George to work with that all throughout his career.
Well, I have great empathy for your situation, having been on both sides of that. So I empathize with your position as well, because there's no way you would have known.
No.
And when George did a commercial one time in Southern California, and there was no way he could read his script. And of course, nobody could understand that.
Yeah.
So he was up all night trying to memorize that. Scott, Paul, Frank, it took 30 some odd takes to get that commercial done. It just was heartbreaking. So I feel for your athlete as well, for both of you.
Yeah. Don, I'd love to hear from you. Obviously, his ethic as a golfer, and that's what I love about this sport so much at the highest level. And, you know, it's such a game of great integrity. And obviously, George represented that. What else can you just share about us as a person? George, obviously nobody knew him better than you. What else would you like our listeners to know about him?
Well, I think if somebody were to ask me one word to describe him, the word that I would use is courageous, because
yes,
so many of his struggles were silent, and no one did know. And it wasn't just the reading, but he really had a pretty weak physicality. So if people would ask, well, how come he didn't play in more U.S. Opens? Well, he had a compromised immune system. And in those days, they had to qualify 36 holes twice. And then they had to play 36 holes on Sunday. Well, physically, there was no way that he could do that. And then he ended up with the 7 surgeries. And each time he came back from that, that's pretty extraordinary. Think of how the press views Tiger Woods with his leg right now. And how miraculous really it is he's come back and even made a cut. Think of that 7 times with George at 6'6" with a compromised immune system and think, how in the heck did he do that? So I think I would like the audience to understand that George Archer personally was just an incredibly courageous person who didn't have very many gifts in the gift basket. And so for him to have achieved what he did is pretty miraculous, actually.
Well, I'm sure if George were on this interview, he would say that his partner in life was a big part of that as well.
Was Donna, his greatest accomplishment.
Yeah, Donna, you are amazing. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate everything you do for literacy in Northern California and for keeping George's legacy alive. And I love you so much, and I love what the foundation is doing.
Love you too, and couldn't do it without you, Frank.
Well, thank you.
I mean, with all my heart, and I'm very happy to talk to Scott and Paul, and I'm very appreciative of the interview. Thank you so much.
Well, Don, it's the first time we've spoken, but I've already fallen in love with you, so.
She has that effect on people.
Yes, absolutely.
It's the George Archer Foundation for Literacy. You can Google it and you can help. We would love to see you do that. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports 1140. Back right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
Golf to Go Radio Hour continues here on Sactown Sports 1140. As you know, Northern California is rich with an incredible amount of golf courses. I almost feel guilty sometimes when I think of other parts of the country and what we have to offer. But as part of the Golf to Go credo, we like to introduce you to golf courses, some of which you already know and some you may not know. And there's a little treasure that sits up at North Lake Tahoe. And it's called Old Brockway Golf Course, and it's got some great history. And Lane Lewis, the owner of Old Brockway, is here with us. Lane, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
This little 9-hole golf course that you own is a treasure. I mean, it sits right across the street, basically from this beautiful lake, and it's got history, which we're going to get into, but I guess the first thing I would say is, you know, it's family owned. What makes somebody go buy a golf course?
Well, you know, back in 1980, I sort of fell into it haphazardly. I was supposed to relieve a person up here that went on vacation, and the corporation gave the person a permanent vacation. And then a year later, the pros that were running the golf course were embezzling from the corporation. So I said, hey, this looks like a good idea. So in 1981, I started leasing it from a corporation and ended up buying the course in 1992.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And not unlike some of the early days of Old Brockway, when you had everything from movie stars to gangsters playing there.
Oh gosh, we've had everybody. I mean, we'll start with you can go back from the presidents to Charlie Chaplin to Bing Crosby, Bob Hope. The first Crosby was played here in 1934 and 35 before it became any PGA event. But Bing had this as a working vacation when he entertained at the Cal Neva, and it got so big. Then after 2 years, it moved down to his home in Rancho Santa Fe, and in 1938 on, it was a Pebble.
You know, what humble beginnings, really, huh? For Bing Crosby to invite a few of his friends, and now it's it maybe is the most recognizable golf tournament going on the PGA Tour, the AT&T National Pro-Am. Talk about some of the other people that have played up there, from, you know, Sinatra and the Rat Pack and folks like that.
Oh, gosh, when Frank owned the Cal Neva here, I mean, the Rat Pack would be playing here every afternoon before entertaining. And we have a few holes on the course, holes 1, 2, 3, 8, and 9 that come back to the clubhouse. And that was named after Dean Martin as the whiskey run. Dean couldn't finish a full 9 before heading back to the bar. I mean, the history here, I mean, the course is designed by John Duncan Dunn. I mean, Dunn was one of the foremost architects of the turn of the century. He built Shinnecock and 4 other U.S. Open courses. And it's the only course that he's built that's still in its exact original shape since 1924. One of our sister courses, Old Brockway in Northwoods in down in Rio Vista, which is an Alistair McKenzie course, are the only two courses west of the Mississippi that made the top 10 9-hole courses in the country. And there's over 4,000 of us.
And those are two really beautiful courses. You know, you talk about it being in the original condition, and certainly you're referring to design, because the conditioning at your golf course is remarkable. You know, especially for a golf course. What do you open in May and close in October or something like that?
Well, we're located in the banana belt of Lake Tahoe. The Kings Beach Tahoe Vista area is a little warmer than other sections of the lake, because we have a shelf out there that goes about 4,000 to 5,000 yards out into the lake, and it's only 6 feet deep. So the ambient air temperature is heated up by the water temperature, and it'll be 4 to 5 degrees difference in Kings Beach as opposed to Tahoe City or the South Shore. So It could be raining. It could be snowing at Tahoe City, and it'll be raining in at Old Brockway. But it allows us to get an early start, and we always aim for Masters weekend, which is first weekend in April. And we try to stay open. We're first open, last to close. We try to stay open through Thanksgiving weekend every year.
You know, it's a classic design. Obviously, you would expect from when it was built. I mean, long before golf carts and things like that, probably Hickory golf clubs were involved in the design, but when you think about how the course is laid out, it's very, very easy to walk because of those, you know, things that you know, you go basically from green to tee without much effort, and I find that really delightful as a nice walk as well.
It's a great walk. It's a 3-mile walk around the course. And, you know, like you said, being in before the golf course being designed before golf carts, coming off the green, you go right to the tee. There's very little distance in between them. And out in the back of the course, it's just all nature and everything. It's, you know, we have this, we try to groom the course exactly like John Duncan Dunn wanted to envision it back in 1924. It was one of the longest golf courses built in 1924. I mean, if you could imagine playing hickory sticks at 6,800 yards, that was probably the equivalent of about 8,500 to 8,600 yards with regular clubs. And in fact, the course record still has never been broken here. It was Jack Purcelli from the Sonoma Mission Inn set the course record of 31 in 1931. Now, I've had it tied a few times, but I don't recognize it until it's broken, because Jack did it with hickories.
Yo, wow, that's a great record then. I read something that I found really interesting. You talk about nature. Yours was the first course in America to get Audubon Cooperative Sanctuary?
Yeah, we were the first 9-hole course the United States to get that designation. That was my superintendent, Dave Laurie. He's been with me for 32 years, and like he said, he wakes up every morning to go out and take care of the old lady. That's what he refers to Old Brockway as. And it's really interesting, because, you know, we have all these natural wetlands areas, and we're in an environmental zone. We're right next to the lake. So our environmental regulations are quite heavy, but we've been able to stay always a step ahead of them using natural filtration areas, our groundwater modeling. Actually, the water leaving the golf, the water entering the golf course is cleaner when it leaves the golf course than when it started.
We're talking with Lane Lewis, the owner of Old Brockway Golf Course at North Lake Tahoe. Scott, I know you love mountain golf. Have you ever had a chance to play Old Brockway?
I just feel like I'm less of a human being and golfer for not having played this course yet. And my first thought, Frank, is, you know, we're a part of the Media League here in Sacramento. We play nine holes every Wednesday at Hagen Oaks, which is a fabulous course. But why have we not scheduled one of the weeks to be at an Old Brockway? I do not understand that for the life of me.
You may have stumbled on something.
I'm waiting for the call now.
I am there. I am looking at the front of your website, and I'm assuming it's the first tee with Lake Tahoe in the background and the clubhouse to the left. Is that correct?
That is correct. We have a fabulous restaurant right here, Spindle Shakes. We got full golf facilities. We got a practice range. We have practice green. It's fully complemented with the course going out there. So that typical comment I get at Old Brockway was, I've been driving past this for 20 years. I finally stopped and played. Now I won't play anywhere else. So
I am just so impressed with what I'm seeing. And I'm just wondering, in terms of the nine holes, just if somebody gets out there, you talked about the nature and the environment. I mean, 31 seems like an impossible score because it looks anywhere you're around, you're in a tree or you're in the water if you're not on the green.
I say to everybody, it's very simple to play. All you do is have to hit it straight and be below the pin. I mean, our greens, you know, don't forget, back in 1924,
they're postage stamps greens, right?
3,400, 4,000 square feet. And, you know, back then they were mowing in them at an inch. Now we're in an eighth of an inch. So there's a lot of play in those greens.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's tough finding a legal pin placement.
I bet.
But, you know, you mentioned,
you know, if you want to get into something that this is just like, you know, I out there marshaling the course, watching people play. Mm-hmm. You know, I hear a lot of people just put on their boom boxes, old Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, and just go out and encompass the journey.
You mentioned the restaurant. I know you remember I had the good fortune about 8 years ago to come up there with the KVIE Channel 6 crew when I was hosting the golf series that we did with them, Tee Time Northern Golf in Northern California. But the one thing that I noticed as I kind of sat in the restaurant and we talked a little bit was how the visitors to Lake Tahoe and your regulars, and you certainly have a lot of both, just really seemed to kind of get along with each other. It was just a really friendly vibe. And you know, I think you get to some place like Old Brockway and you kind of take a deep breath and all those troubles kind of go away.
You know, it's we're the last family owned and operated golf course up here in Lake Tahoe in Northern Nevada. And it's, you know, when I first started out 42 years ago, we were all family owned and operated. I have two of my boys out there working it. My wife here helped me out in the pro shop. My daughter-in-law, it's a family operation. And we just take a lot of pride in what we do here. And we want to treat everybody like it's their course that they're coming to play with and have just a great golfing experience out there. And it's truly, out in the back portion of the golf course as you're playing around, you'll hopefully feel that comfort zone out there.
You know, it's amazing how you are right there on, what is that, 267, I guess, or something?
Right.
But you get in the back of the golf course, it's like you've walked out in the middle of the forest. You don't even know that you're, you know, so close to kind of the hustle and bustle of the area. It's beautiful. Now, I will say, I will have to admit, I haven't played from one to nine all the way through, but we shot footage on, you know, four or five of the holes. So I got to play enough of them to know that your advice about hitting it straight and getting below the hole is probably something that I'm not capable of, but I look forward to the challenge.
Yeah, I tell you. I mean, when I'm coming around, I mean, it's not an easy golf course by any means. But, you know, the main thing is just watching the smiles on the faces as our golfers go by. They're totally, most of them, it's a unique experience. I mean, I'm getting a lot of people flying in from all over the country just to play Old Brockway, seeing, you know, because of the interest in the old courses and things. And they're just blown away by the time they finish. It's where they've really enjoyed the experience.
That's pretty good when you get them, flying in from other places because of the reputation. You know, you and Northwood, top 10 of 9-hole golf courses. That's pretty much the upper echelon of I wouldn't even say just 9-hole golf courses, but golf experiences. I mean, those are two pretty incredible golf courses that you know, yours and Northwood over in Bodega Bay area.
Yeah, Gaylord Chapp runs Northwood, and I, we always at the end of the season, we always get together and saying, how can we make these things work better? So we collaborate, work things out, and you know, it's just, you know, with this industry, we're in the entertainment industry, and you know, people are coming up here, most of them coming up out of the Bay Area, you know, want to come up and relax and just have a nice round of golf. What we're really noticing with the COVID and prior to COVID is the amount of millennials that are coming into the sport, because all the publications back 5 or 10 years ago were saying we're going to experience a millennial boom with 9-hole courses, because the millennials want a quick round of golf. They're not necessarily looking for a 18-hole round of golf. They want a quality round of golf with great dining, and that's where we fit right in. And we've been noticing quite a bit more younger players, and it's great to see that section of people coming into the game at a very high clip.
Yeah, great for the golf course, and certainly great for the game. All right, we've piqued the interest. We've let them know why they ought to play there. How do we make a tee time, Lane?
Okay, all you need to do to make a tee time at Old Brockway is go to oldbrockway.com, click a tee time, and register and get your time. And I look forward to seeing all you golfers out here at one point or another.
You know, I was just going to say, and I bet you're going to be around to greet them. I mean, that's another great thing about, you know, about it being an owner operator. I mean, your office is right upstairs there, and so you're in and out of the pro shop all the time, and greeting people and thanking them for being there, and what a great experience.
Yeah, you'll always get at least one part of the family here. I can't be 24/7 all the time.
That is Lane Lewis. He is the owner of Old Brockway Golf Course in North Lake Tahoe. It's an experience you owe yourself to try. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour, Sactown Sports 1140.